Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the show, maybe you've heard about e-bikes or electric bicycles, but you're not sure what they are. But the very definition of an e-bike could ultimately determine where they're allowed on public lands.
An e-bike is not a bicycle. It's a motorized vehicle.
For our series Belonging, two young Wyomingites who live in Washington, D.C. talk about what's stopping them from moving back to the state.
I've been exposed to just a lot of different kinds of people and a lot of different ideas in a way that makes going back to Wyoming sometimes really hard.
And what the history trapped in layers of ice and glaciers tells us about the future of climate change.
We could rival the biggest things that nature has done, and we can be faster than virtually all of them.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Electric bicycles, or e-bikes as they're known, are having a moment. Right now, they're the fastest growing segment of the country's bike market. But what exactly are they? As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, that question is at the heart of the debate over the Department of the Interior's decision to allow them on public lands.
If you're anything like me, you've never been on an e-bike before. You might not even know what it looks like.
Here's how it works.
That's Dewey Gallegos, owner and operator of the Pedal House. It's a bike shop in downtown Laramie, Wyoming. I'm here to find out what all the e-bike fuss is about. So Gallegos is giving me a tutorial.
And if you, before you get on it, just kind of lift it and move it around, you're like...
Yeah, how much does this bike weigh?
This one probably weighs about 55 pounds.
That's really heavy for a bike. But Gallego says thanks to the electric motor, I won't notice its weight.
Okay.
Nice and simple. Turn the power on.
He hits a button on a small LED screen on the bike's handlebars. It connects to the motor, a long black box in the middle of the frame. He says there are four different modes that you can toggle between.
First level's Eco. That's usually where I start. There's Tour as well, Sport, and then the zippy little Turbo. Turbo's a lot of fun.
Depending on the type of e-bike, you may need to pedal for the motor to work, or the motor does all the work for you. I try one that requires pedaling and take it out for a spin in downtown Laramie. That's when I get it.
I'm never giving this back.
It rides like a dream. So light and way quieter than I expected. It's easy to imagine how much easier it would make my ride to work, especially in the wind or the snow. I whiz around Laramie for about half hour, but eventually I have to give it back. Dewey Gallegos gets it. He thinks commuting is the best use of e-bikes. When it comes to wild places like public lands, though, Gallegos is of two minds.
I understand it can help a lot of people who wouldn't be out there get out there. They're not going to come ripping past us and, you know, change the face of recreation in Wyoming.
On the other hand, Gallegos says there are some types of e-bikes he doesn't want to see anywhere near public lands, like the ones that are fully motorized and don't require pedaling, or the ones that can go up to 28 miles per hour. But here's the thing. The order signed by the Interior Department back in August doesn't differentiate between the different kinds of e-bikes. All of them will now have the same access to public lands as regular non-motorized bikes. And that concerns Dan Smitherman with the Wilderness Society. He doesn't like any of this, and he's also upset about how it all went down.
This was an arbitrary top-down rule that didn't have any public input whatsoever and was done outside the normal travel management process.
Smitherman's nonprofit organization, along with dozens of conservation and recreation groups, have signed an official letter objecting to any attempt to allow e-bikes on non-motorized trails. Smitherman says the agency's decision sets a dangerous precedent and could open up wild places to all kinds of motorized machines.
We have non-motorized trails and motorized trails for a reason. The backcountry area of the forest should not be motorized. And an e-bike is not a bicycle. It's a motorized vehicle.
William Perry Penley disagrees.
Our philosophy is that e-bikes are not off-road vehicles. They are like bicycles.
Penley is the acting director for the Bureau of Land Management right now. He likens the arrival of e-bikes to when snowboards started showing up on ski slopes.
You know, at the time, it was almost heresy.
why are these people here on these funny looking boards?
In other words, Penley says it's a matter of trail users getting used to something new. Penley says the big idea behind the e-bike push from the Department of Interior is to get more people out on public lands. And e-bikes do make it easier for people with limitations or disabilities to get out on the trails.
The grandparents, instead of sitting in the parking lot waiting for the kids and the grandkids to get back, could be out there as well.
While no public comment was gathered before the order came out, it did instruct agencies to submit a timeline for collecting that public input. Penley says he expects that to open soon. In the meantime, if you're looking to buy an e-bike, it will cost you. The low end comes in around $1,500. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Wyoming is one of the states with the most surviving glaciers in the lower 48 states, and trapped in layers of all that ice is an intricate history of life on Earth. During a visit to the University of Wyoming this week, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down to talk with Nobel Peace Prize-winning geoscientist Richard Alley about what this history tells us about climate change.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit, just to kind of try to explain how it is that ice can capture history.
So an ice sheet is a 2 mile thick, continent-wide pile of old snow squeezed to ice under the weight of more snow. And they spread under their own weight, so the east side of Greenland's going east and the west side is going west. And then there's layers in between that are just slowly being stretched and thinned. And they occasionally get messed up by the flow, but there's more than 100,000 years in order, like tree rings. You know, here, when you get snow in Wyoming, if you have a lot of snow, it's usually fairly clean looking. And if you have just a little snow, it can be a little dirty. But if there was a dust storm when it's snowing, the snow will be dirtier. So there's always this question, when you see dirtier snow, was it more dirt or less snow? But now we know how much it snowed each year. So we can turn how much dirt is in there into what was coming out of the air. And in there, there's dust. And you can analyze the dust and find out where it came from. And there's micrometeorites from space. And there's funny isotopes that are made by cosmic rays that tell you how strong the magnetic field was and how active the sun was. And there's smoke from forest fires. So you can ask how many forest fires are going on upwind. We see in Greenland, you see the lead from a little tiny bit of lead from the Romans digging up lead to make plumbing.
Is that right?
Plumbum is plumbing, is lead. And there's a little bit. And then there's this huge amount of lead from the Industrial Revolution and leaded paint and then leaded gasoline. And then we decided to clean it up and the lead drops. And so sitting there in the ice is this record of anything going through the air that we put there, or that nature put there, that came down from space, and the record of the air. And the record of the climate, how cold or warm it was and how much it was snowing. And so they're all in there together. So it's a phenomenal record.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about how it is that this record is teaching us something about climate change, human-made climate change? What signs are there of that?
Before humans, what we find very clearly, the climate is highly changeable. Climate changes for many reasons, but greenhouse gases are especially important in controlling the climate. And this is one of those things you will occasionally meet the person who says, well, climate has always changed, so we shouldn't worry. But what we actually find is climate has always changed. Those changes have always affected living things. And they have especially been because of changes in CO2. We are now driving changes in CO2 that are not yet bigger than what nature has done, but we could rival the biggest things that nature has done, and we can be faster than virtually all of them. And so we see very clearly the recent rise in temperature. We see very clearly the recent rise in CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide, other things that we're driving.
Yeah. And so I wonder, in your travels, have you seen some of the effects of climate change on some of these places that you visited?
Go almost anywhere now that there are glaciers, and they have retreated quite a lot. And the record is very clear. The record is very, very convincing. And it's across virtually every glacier on the planet now that they're melting back. And our expectation is people with a lot of tools and a lot of money and a lot of wherewithal are going to weather this fine. But there's a lot of people in the world today who are living pretty close to the edge. And the history is very clear that even small changes have had big impacts on people that were having troubles already. And so you get this real worry for either holding down climate change or helping those people or both, because there's going to be stresses coming for a lot of the world's population.
It's almost like using the past as a way to see the future.
That's surely what we hope we're doing, and thank you.
Yes. And so, you know, keeping that in mind, I mean, what message would you want to pass on about climate change?
Right. So it's real. Yes, we are causing it. Yes, it will influence us. No, it is not the end of the world. But if we use our knowledge, we can get a bigger economy. We can get more jobs. We can improve national security, we can improve health, and we can also help the environment while we're doing this. And that's the message from this vast effort of scientists and social scientists and economists to take this information in, is in the end, using our knowledge can make us better off.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The climate crisis is threatening traditional ways of life throughout Indian country. Tribal leaders and scientists are working together to help reservations become more climate resilient. But as the Mountain West News Bureau's Noah Glick reports, Native voices believe indigenous science should play a greater role.
Daniel Mosley heads up fisheries for the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe in northern Nevada.
We're trying to figure out why are our fish getting smaller.
He's talking about the Lahontan cutthroat trout, an important cultural animal to Mosley's tribe and a species that's currently threatened. Pyramid Lake is one of the fish's few natural homes. Mosley says climate change is changing the water quality of the lake, and that's not all.
These extended droughts and the fires and the invasive weeds, the plants that are coming in are causing fires, all those things that affect our people.
Mosley says in drought years, Pyramid Lake's water level can drop up to 4 feet, and that makes it harder to sustain trout populations. He says the tribe now has their own reservoir upstream that they can pull from for fish spawning, but that only came about through decades-long litigation.
It's a long, long-term, you know, two generations. We started this in the 1940s.
It's issues like this that led to the creation of Native Waters on Arid Lands, a soon-to-end five-year project funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Its goal is to create more climate resiliency on reservations. The project recently held a two-day tribal summit in Reno, Nevada, where tribal members, scientists, and academics met to discuss ways to share climate data.
Hi, everyone. If you can just take a minute to wrap up.
After an introductory panel, an older man with long graying hair and a faded denim jacket delivers an impromptu address to the crowd.
We're talking about native waters, but we've just seen our white brothers and sisters up here.
Chili Yazi is a member of the Navajo Nation.
Our concern is that science and technology, Western society, feel they may have the answers.
But he believes traditional knowledge is the answer.
Traditional knowledge is indigenous science.
That's Helen Fillmore. She's a hydrologist with the Native Waters on Arid Lands Project and a member of the Washoe tribe near Lake Tahoe. She says traditional knowledge can complement Western science.
Our communities have been in the same areas for thousands of years, and so they have knowledge about the local environment from those lessons, those experiences.
For example, leaving livestock on the rangelands during wildfires because their hoof marks reduce erosion and collect water for seeds when the rains come. or using prescribed burns not only to prevent wildfires, but to also prepare the land for certain crops. But Fillmore says over time, some traditions have been forgotten.
There are things that we don't remember in our communities. We don't remember how to do prescribed burns. So we have to kind of get training on that in a way.
These cells also produce 0.5 volt.
The summit provides plenty of training on new skills and technology. On this sunny day, there's a hands-on solar panel workshop so tribal members can install and run their own solar projects.
And then I want you to work with some tools here.
It's this collaboration and this merging of Western science with traditional knowledge that Helen Fillmore hopes can make a difference for the next generation, including her 11 nieces and nephews.
I don't want to leave them with a world where they can't have access to the things that make our life and our culture so beautiful. And I don't want to be one of those people who took that away from them. So I think it's important to me to do what I can within my lifetime to give that to them.
Native Waters on Arid Lands is wrapping up its 5-year project cycle. Officials with the program say the next step is to create hyper-localized solutions and workshops for tribal communities across the region. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
Coming up, we'll have a discussion with an author on the history of disabilities, and Senator Enzi is excited about a new way of producing a federal budget. This is Open Spaces. You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. The author of a book called A Disability History of the United States is visiting the University of Wyoming this week as part of a celebration of the Wyoming Institute for Disabilities. Kim Nielsen is a professor of disability studies at the University of Toledo. Her book was not planned.
Yeah, I came into this field by accident. I'm trained as a historian of women in politics, and ended up writing a political biography of Helen Keller. And that was the beginning of my slippery slope into disability history. Yeah, just amazing field. I love it. You know, there's so much of a really rich history in disability, and there's so much activism that matters in history and shaped all of our experiences, whether we define as disabled or not. And there's so many issues yet today that matter.
Well, we'll get to that in just a second. But in history, I mean, there were some ugly periods where people were killed and thrown off of ships and all kinds of things. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, there really were some ugly periods in which people with disabilities in the U.S. were really disregarded and institutionalized. They're given a lack of access to health care, denied health care, sometimes forcibly sterilized, forcibly institutionalized for some of them their entire lives. And certainly the example you refer to is that we know that Africans being forced to come to the United States as slaves were, when disabled, often disregarded and, in this case, thrown off ships and simply left to die. So that we have a really long, sometimes sad history of disability in the U.S. And, you know, what amazes me always and what I think about in these instances is, despite these really horrid histories sometimes, that always people with disabilities sought to create really rich communities and support relationships and forge their own lives and, you know, do what they could to make lives of just rich lives like everybody wants.
Yeah, tell me about Helen Keller's an example, but tell me about maybe a couple of people that we don't know about that made a big difference.
Oh, you know, maybe an example of how people have been integrated into communities and matter. I used this example yesterday of a 17th century man named Joseph Gorman. And we don't you know much about him, and 17th century diagnoses are sort of meaningless today, but he's someone who could not write, and he had a difficult time communicating with people and would wander around town. And yet, the historical records show that he had two skills that were highly, highly valued in his community. He could beat everyone at checkers. And, you know, in the age before television and radio and your iPhones, this mattered. And then he also could look at any pile of produce and tell you how much it weighed.
Wow.
And I love this example because, you know, this is a man who, you know, we look backwards and assume he had some sort of cognitive or developmental disability, but was highly valued by his community because he had these two skills that people cared about. Mm-hmm. And in 17th century New England, his skill at checkers and his skills at figuring out weight mattered. And he was important to the town economy. Mm-hmm. You know, as people traded wheat or corn or whatever, he mattered. And there are these examples all throughout U.S. history of people with disabilities who were integrated into the community and had an impact.
How have we done with dealing with disabilities as a society, making things easier for people with disabilities, that sort of thing, when you compare it to things such as women's rights and civil rights?
Mm-hmm. It's really been an uneven record. Although certainly when various civil rights movements began in the U.S., disability was always part of those.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the first civil rights legislation, actually, of 1964, disability had been in the first draft, making it illegal to discriminate on basis of disability. It got written out and did not happen until 1990, several decades later.
Wow.
But the early civil rights movements at least circled around and sometimes thought about disability, although generally failed to include it when push came to shove. There was a lot of overlap in activism and in thought. For example, one of the lawyers for Brown v. Board, the major civil rights piece of legislation regarding race and education, was a white man who was blind and who was very involved in thinking about rights broadly and extending that to all populations. So while civil rights movements generally weren't great about thinking about disability, it was always there in the discussions and part of the early activist movements. I always think about the early U.S. Senate building had no women's restrooms. And when women began to enter the Senate, whether as senators themselves or people who worked for the senators, many folks argued that we shouldn't let them in because it would be too expensive to make a women's restroom. And, you know, I just think that's wrong. It's just wrong. And, you know, so well, sometimes access costs money, sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to think about our priorities as a nation and of inclusion and of citizenship access. And just as we need, you know, restrooms for women, we need restrooms for everybody and sometimes disabled women.
You know, so I guess one could present the argument that there's been certainly great advances, and I imagine technology has played this huge role in this. But I imagine you're going to tell me that we still have a ways to go.
We do. We have a ways to go. People with disabilities live disproportionately in poverty, are unemployed, have lower educational success rates, and not because of their own deficiencies, but because of the resistance put up against them. And we still have a long ways to go. I think what's always striking to me about disability is that this is a community that nearly all of us go in and out of. As we age or as things happen to us, you know, life circumstances, whether it's temporary or permanent, we all go in and out of this community. And all of us have loved ones who go in and out of this community. And so I think we improve all of our lives by thinking about disability and access.
Kim Nielsen, again, is the author of A Disability History of the United States, available on Amazon and other places. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi may be retiring, but that doesn't mean he's relaxing in Washington these days. This week, the budget committee that he chairs passed a historic bipartisan proposal to reform how the entire federal government spends money, as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
As we've reported before, Senator Mike Enzi isn't known for outbursts of emotion, But this week, he was celebrating the passage of his budget reform proposal in his very Mike Enzi sort of way.
Very exciting. Especially exciting once I found out that that's the first bipartisan budget reform bill to come out of committee in 30 years.
Enzi's been calling for sweeping budget reforms for years now. At one point, he even proposed nixing his own budget committee because he felt it became useless. That's because, unlike in Wyoming, in Washington, the budget committee doesn't dole out money. That's handled by the Appropriations Committee. And Enzi was sick of laying out a budget blueprint, only to see lawmakers in both parties routinely break those parameters. That's why his proposal seeks to constrain lawmakers through things like increasing transparency and giving them more power to tackle the deficit.
This can make a huge difference for the country.
The new proposal does rename and reorient his budget committee by turning it into the Fiscal Control Committee, which will be focused on reining in the debt and deficit. The proposal would move Washington to a two-year budget, as opposed to the current one-year one, which many blame for all these government shutdowns. It also enacts something called portfolio review. Enzi says that will allow Congress to better evaluate spending on, say, federal housing policy, which he's quick to point out currently consists of 160 housing programs administered by 20 different agencies.
Nobody's in charge. Nobody sets goals. Nobody checks to see if they did anything. A lot of the money goes to people working in D.C. rather than out where we expected the money to go. Portfolio review will make that grossly noticeable.
Enzi's plan also seeks to speed up the current lag between when the executive branch has spending data and when Congress is given that same data, which Enzi bemoans as currently too late in the process. All these sweeping changes seem to have come together because Enzi is trusted. Here's his lead Democratic co-sponsor on budget reforms, Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, discussing why he agreed to corral his troops and help Enzi pass it out of committee.
What Chairman Enzi has assured me of is that it will go through regular order and there won't be tricks associated with trying to ram it onto the floor. And I am very supportive of having a robust and open process where we get to work through whatever the issues are.
That means the proposal still faces an uphill battle, which is evident when you ask Republican senators why the federal debt currently sits at a record high of more than $23 trillion.
How about the last 10 years? I mean, in one presidency, we doubled the debt under President Obama.
Where the spending's increasing is on the entitlement side.
Until we really look at how we want a long-term deal with Social Security and Medicare, we're not going to be able to get to a completely balanced budget.
Those are Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan, and Georgia Senator David Perdue. But Senator Enzi's partner on his budget reform proposal, Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island, begs to differ with Barrasso and others in the GOP. He says the GOP runs fast and loose with the nation's credit cards when they're in power, whether under President George W. Bush or even now under Trump.
I think it's factually inaccurate to say that the deficits we're running and the debt load that we carry doesn't relate to the unpaid-for war and two rounds of unpaid-for tax cuts. I think that's just factually inaccurate.
Still, Barrasso and others in the GOP say entitlement reform is essential. He says the time to strike on these massive and hyper-partisan issues is when there's two parties controlling separate parts of the government.
The time to really deal with big problems, big concerns like this is in divided government. And we have a Republican Senate and President, and we have a Democrat House. So it would seem that this would be a time to address the issue, and I'm ready to do it. We need to get enough cooperation across the board to get it done, because this problem is continuing to mount.
While Enzi's supportive of entitlement reforms, he also avoided including those prickly issues in this deal, which is how it passed out of his committee with bipartisan support. His proposal also forces lawmakers to make long-term fiscal targets in order to avoid the rapid reforms countries like Greece and South Korea have had to adopt in recent years.
If we do that, then we're doing the same corrective things that these other countries had to do in order to get the confidence back. And that should keep the confidence in the American dollar and also maintain the value of the American dollar.
As for its chances before the full Senate, and then even melding it with a House version, Enzi's holding out hope, even in these hyperpartisan times.
Well, if it's bipartisan, there's a chance of actually getting it finished, which is the next step.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
If you listen to Wyoming Public Radio, you no doubt have heard the reoccurring promos for the Modern West. Some of you probably have checked out the new and improved podcast, but for the rest of you, podcast producer Melody Edwards shifts into the guest chair to explain what it's all about.
Well, we had been, as reporters in the newsroom, coming back to the station with just these stories sometimes that were so rich that we couldn't quite stuff them into the space of a 4 or 5 minute story. And we always were very sad when we would have these piles of amazing audio from all around the region that we just felt so sad to let it go. And I kept thinking I would love to be able to do something a little longer. And so as we started thinking about it, we realized that the Modern West could do more. It had the potential to be take up a bigger space, do more work, and we just jumped right in.
So what are you trying to do with this show now?
Take people, whether you're a Westerner and you just love being out in, you know, the spaces of the West, or whether you're maybe from the diaspora that's moved away from the West, bring you into some of these really amazing places around the West, into these communities. We're also really interested in trying to kind of break up some stereotypes. People kind of have these ideas about the West as cowboys and Indians and pioneers and, you know, sort of these fur trappers and things like this. And those are real stereotypes. Those all exist. But there's a lot more. And a lot of times, for instance, I'm working on a story with Cooper right now about coal miners in Gillette. And one of the first coal miners that he interviews is a woman, a single mom. And so, yes, there are coal miners, but it's time for us to kind of shake up some of the stereotypes. And so that's another really interesting aspect of what the Modern West is going to try to do.
So what are some of the episodes that you've had already? Because I'm sure there are people that may have missed this.
For instance, Camila Kudelska, our CODI reporter, did a really cool story where she explored rural midwives and how a lot of hospitals are closing down around the rural West. And so she went out and found that there was midwives who were kind of stepping in because one of the first things to go is the maternity wards. And so she found a midwife who was kind of helping with that issue. Another example, the one that I worked on was that there was, I went to a women's outdoor camp where I learned to shoot a bow, I learned how to fly fish, because women are really stepping in and becoming hunters and anglers, even as men are doing those things a lot less. So that was really exciting. Ended up going fly fishing with my dad even.
So you also got a big grant, and tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we got the Project Catapult. We were actually cordially invited to apply because they were specifically looking for podcasts that were about rural places. We were one of 6 podcasts that were selected from around the country, and they gave us quite a chunk of change to really start to explore this podcast and really get it out there and do some really high-quality work with our reporting around the West.
You know, and I think the thing that we want to stress is while we'll have a Wyoming audience for these things, your goal is to go beyond state borders.
That's right. It was really interesting when I went to our first Project Catapult event, we had some judges that were, you know, listening to our pitch and seeing what we could do with it. And we found that there was lots of people who used to live in the West who've moved away and who are still very interested in connecting to the West. Or there's people who visited Yellowstone and love it and would love to hear more stories about it. So we realize that there is a national audience for this.
So far, it's been folks from our newsroom. My understanding is you might go beyond that.
That's right. We're going to be trying to find freelancers, audio reporters from all around who want to explore, you know, what it means to be a Westerner. So we're really excited about bringing in some new voices.
If I want to hear the Modern West, where can I find it?
You can find us at themodernwest.org.
Melody Edwards, who is a one of the hosts and the producer of The Modern West. Always nice to have you with us.
Thanks.
In a moment, Savannah Marr has the latest in our Belonging series with a couple of folks who live away from Wyoming, and we will hear about an award-winning play that's coming to Laramie. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Around 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds leave the state each year. So Wyoming Public Radio has turned the microphone over to young people to talk about what's behind their decisions to stay or go. Sarah Mock and Mackenzie Muirhead grew up in Cheyenne. Now they both live across the country in Washington, D.C. Sarah and Mackenzie say they both feel pulled to come back to Wyoming, but a lack of jobs in their chosen fields of journalism and international affairs, respectively, makes that dream unrealistic.
I used to think that I would want to go back to Wyoming and raise my kids in Wyoming, and then I think I started looking at the job market, and that kind of took the notion away from me that I would ever go back to raise my family. I can definitely imagine in 10 years or so, if I have kids, sending them to grandma and grandpa's house for the summer or trying to get them to go to UW. It would be very surprising to me if I was able to go back and find a job. If there were a way to create more jobs in the international realm, then it would induce a lot more people that want to get out. They want to experience other things, but they still have this sense of home and this sense of wanting to give back to home, but not quite being in a position where they know how to do that because the jobs aren't there for them.
Totally. I empathize with that idea really, really deeply, in the sense of like feeling like I gained so much from growing up in Wyoming, especially. I mean, we both were able to take advantage of like paid trips to national conventions, mm-hmm. and just like getting to travel a lot through school, getting to travel a lot in our families. And that, yeah, definitely is why like I felt comfortable coming to Georgetown for college and building a career that, you know, took me to California and back to DC and kind of all over the country. And I, yeah, feeling like you want to give back, but the way to give back seems like moving back. But how do you do that when it doesn't feel like that's actually a real option?
Yeah. So what made you leave Wyoming in the first place for DC?
Okay, so I was very interested in international affairs since like 10th grade, just because I had a very similar, like, you know, I love traveling and I love adventure and I want my life to be very adventurous, but I also love this country and I love Wyoming and I want to somehow tie those things together, and things like the State Department or the Foreign Service felt like the best way to do that. So that's why I left Wyoming and went to Georgetown in the first place. It was kind of nuts, but in all the ways that I thought, I think I would shed agriculture and farming and kind of all of the really rural identity things that came with growing up in Wyoming, I feel like Georgetown just like magnified all of those things, because being from Wyoming became really the most unique thing about me. So I went to Georgetown thinking I was going to work for the State Department and actually ended up basically studying agriculture. And now I'm in DC reporting on agriculture, in a lot of ways closer to Wyoming, my Wyoming roots, than I ever was.
How did you feel about the culture in Wyoming? Did that impact your decision to leave it all?
Definitely not at the time. That's changed since I've been away. I've been exposed to just a lot of different kinds of people and a lot of different ideas in a way that makes going back to Wyoming sometimes really hard. Not only just because of like how I've changed, but also because of how people assume I've changed. I don't know if you experience this, but I almost feel like unwelcome sometimes.
I think there are traces of that, where there are some friends who think like, oh, Kenzie's such a big shot because she left, but she still wants to come back for Frontier Days, and she still wants to come back for the UW football games, and she still says she loves Wyoming, but how much do you really love it if you left? That's kind of hard to confront, because it's just so off base in so many different ways. I think you can love something and not see a future there and leave it and still love it. But I think there will always be something special about Wyoming to people that grew up in Wyoming. It's just whether or not that person wants to stay and whether or not they have found their niche and whether or not there is a job in that niche. In addition to, do I like Wyoming? Do I like the culture here? Do I like how remote it is? Because a lot of people, especially our age, just aren't interested in driving 40 miles for groceries and 100 miles for the closest airport.
Totally. And I feel like, to that point, it's almost like people have opted in to wanting that. Like, there's certainly not other states that really offer what Wyoming offers, which is, yeah, being really remote, being really outdoors focused, mm-hmm. being really rural. Even our biggest city, we grew up in the biggest city in Wyoming, and we both consider ourselves to have grown up in a rural place.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And like, if Wyoming just became like a carbon copy of Colorado, then there would just be two Colorados. And then all the people in Wyoming who currently love it would have nowhere to go.
And I think we are in a little bit of danger for that happening right now, because as Denver expands, people that don't like the size of Denver move to Fort Collins. And as Fort Collins expands, then people move to Cheyenne. And people that are in Cheyenne who don't like how fast Cheyenne is expanding, where do they go? Do they go to Torrington? Do they go to Pine Bluffs? Do they go further up to Casper?
Yeah. In that way, we've created an additional problem, yes. Because the real solving is actually the brain drain is what we all want.
Yeah.
It's the best thing for Wyoming. And also, it's about to end because everyone's going to move in. Yeah, because it's already a suburb of Denver, basically.
Yeah.
And then Laramie's going to go. And then
Laramie is such a gem that should be preserved at all costs because it is the perfect city right now. It's so fun.
But it's also only an hour from Fort Collins, which means Fort Collins is coming for it.
It's an hour out of Fort Collins on 287, which is so dangerous. Such a terrible road.
So true. Will it stop people from Colorado? Yeah. Unclear.
Unclear.
That's Sarah Mock and Mackenzie Muirhead for our series Belonging, where we ask young people to reflect on their place in Wyoming. This piece was produced by Savannah Marr, who's a Report for America core member.
An award-winning play has its Wyoming premiere in Laramie. Madeline George's play, The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence, won an Outer Critics Circle Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2013. As Madeline George told Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary, the inspiration came from the most unlikely of places.
So your play was actually inspired by Jeopardy, correct?
Actually, the way it went backwards for me from the Watson on Jeopardy, who people might know. You know, I grew up reading, obviously, the Sherlock Holmes stories, and my dad, who's a scientist, used to tell us sort of like scientific bedtime stories. And one of them was about the invention of the telephone, you know, where Alexander Graham Bell and his assistant, Thomas Watson, are in like two separate rooms. And the first ever sentence that was said over the wire was Bell saying, "Watson, come here. I want to see you." And so I knew that there were these two Watsons, and I was sort of interested in them. I was like, oh, they're both like assistant guys. They're both like helpers. That's interesting. And I sort of kept it at the back of my mind. And then in 2011, when IBM fielded this AI competitor on Jeopardy, also named Watson, I was like, okay, now that's a thing. Now I've got three Watsons, all of whom are very interesting, very different kinds of like support figures. So that was the sort of origin of the play for me, is thinking through that. And then I ended up thinking, well, what's the difference between the way that we rely on other people and the way that we rely on machines?
So are all the Watson characters in the play interconnected somehow with each other?
It's all connected. And it does this sort of big theatrical sort of trick, which is that all of the Watsons are separate, and yet also they're also the same guy. And then there's a made-up Watson who is in a contemporary story of my own devising. And he is like a IT guy. And it's a kind of a combination mystery love story. And then it's almost like it's the same story all the way through, but it's happening simultaneously in these four different times.
What is it like to sit in an audience and watch your work come to life on stage?
It's very strange. I mean, it's sort of like an out-of-body experience. If you've been working for a long time on a play and you've been hearing it inside your head, it's like you know the people in a way, but also they're a part of you. And then when you see them split off from you and embodied, and then other people are watching it, I don't know, it's definitely a kind of ghostly feeling, like you're sort of everywhere and nowhere in the room while it's happening. And it used to be, literally, I could not tolerate being in the room. I would sit downstairs and listen to the play on the monitor, you know, in a theater. I couldn't stand to watch people watch this weird ghostly version of my soul up on stage while I was in the back of the room. But now I'm very, maybe a little bit stronger as a person, and I'm also very curious to hear the audience reacting. I like to hear audiences laugh and breathe and think, you know, it helps me understand what's happening inside the play and what might need to change.
Now, you are a novelist as well. How does writing a play differ from writing fiction?
I found it very difficult to write fiction. A play is a kind of democratic arrangement of multiple consciousnesses, multiple perspectives, telling one story from all these different angles. I also think like a novel is almost always, it's retrospective. You know, it's like it is an accounting of a thing that happened. And the thing that I love about drama is that it's unfolding in the moment. It's hitting the characters and it's hitting the audience like life hits us. We don't know what's going to happen next. And we're always like reacting and trying to create the conditions for things to happen that we want. That feels to me like a very live form. It's a very interesting way to write for me.
And how did you get started writing plays?
Well, I was a very strange kid and I wrote plays from a very young age, and like a young teenager. And I submitted my little one-act plays as a teenager to this national competition and was brought to New York and had a production at a very young age off Broadway. And then I was like, well, now I'm ruined. Like, this is fabulous. I'll obviously have to do this for the rest of my life, no matter how unrewarding the career might be.
For you, what does the future of theater look like? Is it a dying art form?
Here's what I think. The theater will never die because people are always doing shows for each other, you know, even on the smallest level. Whether, you know, the commercial theater is in a state of health or disrepair, I never really know. I mean, Wicked, the musical, has made more money than any movie in history. So there's that in terms of whether the theater is dying or not. But I think that people's hunger to embody other people, to occupy other perspectives, and to do performance for each other is incredibly powerful and magnetic and keeps people coming back to theater over and over again. And, you know, like Taylor Mack says, he's a playwright and performer. He points out that all theater is local. All theater is local. It only happens in a room with other people. And we're in a time when people feel quite atomized and alienated from each other because the kinds of media that we mostly consume don't connect us. They separate us. And I really have a lot of faith that people's hunger to connect and be close and also be distinct from each other at the same time, that's what theater can give us. And I feel like people will never give that up.
Do you do any acting yourself?
Oh my gosh, no, I would never. I find myself stricken with self-consciousness when I have to get up on stage. It's profoundly embarrassing to me to pretend to be someone else. And actors are they're so easygoing about it. I had an actor say to me the other day, she was like, oh, I'm a terrible liar. And I was like, oh, but you're an actor. And she said, acting is telling the truth. Like very, very offended. That's a particular mindset that I don't have. But I'm so lucky to get to work with people who do.
That's playwright Madeline George talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary, relative theatrics production of The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence runs through November 16th in Laramie.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear an individual segment, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
You know, you can never miss a show by signing up for our podcast, either on that site or wherever you get your podcasts. Catch up on all of our news stories via our Facebook page, and all of our reporters are on Twitter and Instagram. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.